Ichiriki Tea House in the presence of mother, auntie, and mameha. After the ceremony, we all went to a restaurant known as Kicho for dinner. This was a solemn event too, and I spoke little and ate even less. When dinner was over, I went by rickshaw to a beautiful inn on the grounds of the Nanzenji Temple. When Dr. Crab arrived, he told me to make myself comfortable on one of the futons. Then he opened my robe and took a long while to loosen each of the garments beneath it step by step, rubbing his hands over my legs, which I think was supposed to help me relax. This went on for a long time. Then Dr. Crab moved my legs apart and arranged himself on his knees between them. When he untied the sash of his sleeping robe, I closed my eyes and brought a hand up to cover my mouth. The doctor's hands burrowed around for a while, making me very uncomfortable. Then he lowered himself until his body was poised just above mine. I put all the force of my mind to work in making a sort of mental barrier between the doctor and me. But it wasn't enough to keep me from feeling the doctor's eel, as Mameha might have called it, bump against the inside of my thigh. I kept reminding myself how much the doctor had paid for this privilege, and I remember hoping at one point that he was enjoying himself more than I was. Finally, the homeless eel marked its territory, I suppose, and the doctor lay heavily upon me, moist with sweat. Mameha may already have won her bet with Mother, but she still had quite a stake in my future. So during the next few years, she worked to make my face familiar to all her best customers and to the other geisha as well. After 2 years of parties and outings, I made the shift from being an apprentice to being a geisha. This was in the summer of 1938 when I was 18 years old. We call this change turning the collar, because an apprentice wears a red collar, while a geisha wears a white one. No more than 3 weeks after I turned collar, Mother came to me one day while I was eating a quick lunch in the reception room and sat across the table a long while puffing on her pipe. "I came to tell you that this time next month you'll have a danna."
"A danna? But Mother, I'm only 18. Mameha thinks I should establish my reputation first, just for a few years."
"Mameha, what does she know about business? Only a fool would pass up on an offer like the one Nobu Toshikazu has made."
My heart nearly stopped when I heard this. I suppose it was obvious that Nobu would one day propose himself as my danna. After all, he'd made an offer for my Mizuage, and since then had certainly asked for my company more frequently than any other man. But to become his mistress would have closed my life off from the chairman forever. As the afternoon progressed, I began to feel dizzy with a strange buzzing in my head, and soon made my way to Mameha's apartment to talk with her. "Mother tells me that within a month, it's likely I'll have a danna."
"Yes, I know, and the danna will be Nobu Toshikazu."
"Nobu-san is a good man," she said, "and very fond of you."
"Yes, but Mameha-san, I don't know how to say it. This was never what I imagined."
"Nobu-san has always treated you kindly."
"But I don't want kindness."
"Really, Sayuri, what did you think life as a geisha would be like? A romance novel? We don't become geisha so our lives will be satisfying. We become geisha because we have no other choice." I looked up at her with the thought of making one last plea, but when I saw the expression on her face, I thought better of it. A few weeks passed, and then one evening in a hallway at Ichiriki, Mameha suggested the time had come to collect on her bet with Mother. The two of them had wagered about whether my debts would be repaid before I was 20. As it turned out, of course, they'd been repaid already, though I was only 18. "Now that you've turned your collar," Mameha said to me, "I can't see any reason to wait longer." This is what she said, but I think the truth was more complicated.
Several days afterward, I was summoned downstairs to the reception room of our okia to find Mameha and mother across the table from one another. Beside Mameha was a gray-haired woman named Mrs. Okada, whom I'd met a number of times. She was a mistress of the okia where Mameha had once lived, and she still took care of Mameha's accounting in exchange for a portion of the income. After 10 or 15 minutes, the two women agreed on a figure representing how much I'd earned since my debut. Mrs. Okada took a small abacus from her bag and made a few calculations, writing down numbers on a blank page of an account book. Then she said to Mameha,
"I'm sure you must be very pleased that Sayuri will soon be taking a danna, and at only 18 years of age, how young to take such a big step."
18 is a bit young for most girls," Mameha said, "but I'm certain Mrs. Nitta has made the right decision in Sayuri's case. But may I ask, is it true the most generous offer has come from Nobu Toshikazu?"
"His has been the only offer. I suppose that makes it the most generous," Mother said.
I had the impression another man had expressed interest in Sayuri, General Tootori Junosuke. At this point in the conversation, I lost track of what the two of them were saying, for I'd begun to realize that Mameha was making an effort to rescue me from Nobu. I certainly hadn't expected such a thing. I'd met the general more than a few times. He was a bit on the small side, shorter than I was, in fact, but he wasn't the sort of person you could overlook any more than you could overlook a machine gun. He moved very briskly and was always puffing on one cigarette after another so that wisps of smoke drifted in the air around him. By now, Mameha was telling Mother that the general had just taken a new position. He'd been put in charge of something called military procurement. Mameha said, "I think you'll find that General Tootori's new position could be a great help to the okia. Those of us in Gion have been fortunate so far, but shortages will affect us if the war continues." Already in 1938, we'd all grown accustomed to daily reports about the war in Manchuria.
"This war will be over in 6 months," Mother said.
Still, she spent the next week going around Gion and making one phone call after another to learn as much as she could about General Tootori. She was so immersed in this task that sometimes when I spoke to her, she didn't seem to hear me. During this period, I continued seeing Nobu whenever he came to Gion and did my best to act as though nothing had changed. Probably he'd expected I would be his mistress by the middle of July. Certainly I'd expected it. But even when the month came to a close, his negotiations seemed to have led nowhere. During September of that year, while I was still 18 years old, General Tottori and I drank sake together in a ceremony at the Ichiriki Tea House. This was the same ceremony I'd performed with Mameha when she became my older sister, and later with Dr. Crab just before my Mizuage. In the weeks afterward, everyone congratulated Mother for having made such a favorable alliance. On that very first night after the ceremony, I went on the general's instructions to a small inn in the northwest of Kyoto called Suruya. I'd been afraid I'd have to find some way of pleasing him, but as it turned out, all I had to do was follow orders. In the 3 years since my Mizuage, I'd forgotten the sheer terror I'd felt when the doctor finally lowered himself onto me. I remembered it now, but the strange thing was that I didn't feel terror so much as a kind of vague queasiness. As the months passed, the queasiness went away, and my encounters with the general became nothing more than an unpleasant twice-weekly routine. During that fall, when the general became my danna, Nobu ceased inviting me to parties where I'd so often entertained him. Soon I realized he'd stop coming to the Ichiriki altogether. I couldn't think of any reason he should do this, unless it was to avoid me. With a sigh, the mistress of the Ichiriki agreed that I was probably right. At the new year, I wrote Nobu a card, as I did with all of my patrons, but he didn't respond. It's easy for me to look back now and tell you casually how many months passed, but at the time, I lived in anguish. I felt I'd wronged a man who had treated me kindly, a man I'd come to think of as a friend. What was more, without Nobu's patronage, I was no longer invited to Iwamura Electric's parties, which meant I hardly stood any chance at all of seeing the chairman. Mother called me into her room one afternoon in 1939 and told me I'd earned more in the past 6 months than both Hatsumomo and Pumpkin combined.
"Which means," she said, "that it's time for you to exchange rooms with them."
I wasn't as pleased to hear this as you might imagine. Hatsumomo and I had managed to live side by side these past few years by keeping away from one another. But I regarded her as a sleeping tiger, not a defeated one. When I saw Mameha that evening, I told her what Mother had said to me, and mentioned my fears that the fire inside Hatsumomo might flare up again.
"Oh, well, that's fine," said Mameha. "That woman won't be beaten once and for all until we see blood, and we haven't seen it yet. Let's give her a bit of a chance and see what sort of mess she makes for herself."
In the years since my Mizuage, Hatsumomo had gradually been afflicted by some sort of disease of the character, if such a thing exists. She'd lost all control over her drinking, for example, and of her bouts of cruelty, too. Everyone knows that a wounded tiger is a dangerous beast, and for this reason, Mameha insisted that we follow Hatsumomo around Gion during the evenings over the next few weeks. Partly, Mameha wanted to keep an eye on her, but more importantly, Mameha wanted to make Hatsumomo's life difficult for her to bear. For years, Hatsumomo had been very close to the famous kabuki actor Bando Shojiro VI. Whenever he was in town, she visited him. One afternoon, I learned that Shojiro would attend a party later that evening at a tea house in the geisha district of Pontocho, on the other side of the river from Gion. "How perfect," Mameha said when I told her about it. "With all the attention Shojiro is certain to give Hatsumomo at the party, she may feel renewed. Then you and I will come drifting in like some sort of horrid smell from the alleyway and ruin her evening completely." Considering how cruelly Hatsumomo had treated me over the years and how very much I hated her, I'm sure I ought to have been elated at this plan. But somehow conspiring to make Hatsumomo suffer wasn't the pleasure I might have imagined. When we reached the party, Shojiro was persuaded to ask if Mameha would perform, which he did. Already I could see Hatsumomo looking displeased. Mameha performed a few very short pieces. Nearly anyone would have agreed that she was a lovely woman, but very few people would have found her more beautiful than Hatsumomo, so I can't say exactly what caught Shojiro's eye. It may have been the sake he'd drunk, and it may have been Mameha's extraordinary dancing. Whatever it was, by the time Mameha came back to join us at the table, Shojiro seemed quite taken with her and asked that she sit beside him. When she did, he poured her a cup of sake and turned his back on Hatsumomo, as if she were just another adoring apprentice. As far as Mameha, I never saw her flirt with anyone more deliberately than she did with Shojiro. Her voice grew high and soft, and her eyes swished from his chest to his face and back again. Hatsumomo's mouth hardened, and her eyes shrank to about half their size. Then she drew back her hand and slapped Shojiro. I think her aim must have been bad from all the sake she'd drunk, because she hit the side of his head rather than his face. "Hatsumomo-san, please," said Mameha, "do try to calm down." I don't know if Mameha's words had the precise effect she was hoping, or whether Hatsumomo's mind had already shattered, but Hatsumomo threw herself at Shojiro and began hitting him everywhere. I do think that in a way she went crazy. One of the guests, a theater manager, got up from the table and rushed over to restrain her. Somehow, in the middle of all this, Mameha slipped out and returned a moment later with the mistress of the tea house. I don't know what any of us would have done without the calm thinking of the mistress. She spoke to Shojiro in a soothing voice, while at the same time giving the theater manager a signal to take Hatsumomo away. As I later learned, he didn't just take her inside the tea house. He took her downstairs to the front and shoved her out onto the street. Hatsumomo didn't return to the Okiya at all that night. When she did come back the following day, she was summoned at once to Mother's room and spent a long while there. A few days afterward, Hatsumomo left the Okiya, wearing a simple cotton robe Mother had given her, and with her hair as I'd never seen it, hanging in a mass around her shoulders. She carried a bag containing her belongings and jewelry, and didn't say goodbye to any of us, but just walked out to the street. She didn't leave voluntarily. Mother had thrown her out. I don't know for sure whatever became of her. A few years after the war, I heard she was making a living as a prostitute in the Miyagawa-cho district. Over the years, she probably succeeded in drinking herself to death. She certainly wouldn't have been the first geisha to do it. In Japanese, we refer to the years from the Depression through World War II as Kurotani, the Valley of Darkness, when so many people lived like children whose heads had slipped beneath the waves. As is often the case, those of us in Gion didn't suffer quite as badly as others. While most Japanese lived in the Dark Valley all through the 1930s, for example, in Gion we were still warmed by a bit of sun. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you why. Women who are mistresses of cabinet ministers and naval commanders are the recipients of enormous good fortune, and they pass that good fortune along to others. As the darkness continued to settle over Japan, there did finally come a time when even the pinpoint of light in which we'd managed to keep ourselves suddenly went out. It happened at a single moment, early one afternoon, just a few weeks before New Year's Day in December 1942. I was eating my breakfast when a man's voice called out at our entrance. I thought he was probably just making a delivery, so I went on with my meal. But a moment later, the maid interrupted to say a military policeman had come looking for Mother. When Mother walked in, she didn't seem at all surprised to find him, and in fact, she behaved more politely toward him than I'd ever seen her behave toward anyone. She led him into our reception room and served him some of our ill-gotten tea. The door was closed, but I could hear them talking for a long while. At one point, when she came out to fetch something, she pulled me aside and told me this. "General Tottori was taken into custody this morning. You'd better hurry and hide our best things or they'll be gone tomorrow." Within a week of the policeman's visit, our Okiya had been stripped of the things other families had lost long ago, such as stores of food, undergarments, and so forth. One morning in January, I was standing in line at the rice store in the falling snow holding my ration coupons, when the shopkeeper next door put out his head and called into the cold, "It's happened." The geisha in front of me asked what he was talking about. "The war hasn't come to an end, has it?" she said. "The government has announced the closing of the geisha districts," he said. "All of you are to report to the registry office tomorrow morning." I looked at the despair on the faces of the other geisha around me, and I knew in an instant that we were all thinking the same thing. Which of the men we knew would save us? Even though General Tottori had been my danna until the previous year, I certainly wasn't the only geisha acquainted with him. I had to reach him before anyone else did. I wasn't properly dressed for the weather, but I set out at once for the northwest of the city. When I entered his room, General Tottori was sitting at the table listening to a drama on the radio. He switched off the radio.
"You're not the first to come to me," he said. "There's nothing I can do to help you, Sayuri."
"But I rushed here so quickly. I can't imagine how anyone reached you before I did."
"The bombs will fall soon," the general said. "If you want to be alive when this war is over, you'd better find someone who can tuck you away in a safe place." I'm sorry I'm not that man. I've already exhausted what influence I had.
I'd been out of touch with Nobu for more than 4 years by that time. I knew at once I couldn't approach him. As for the chairman, well, I would have grabbed at any excuse just to speak with him, but I could never have asked him a favor. That evening, the Ichiriki was busy with farewell parties. I scarcely heard the maid who told me I was wanted in another room. She opened the door of a small tatami room I'd never entered before, and there at the table, alone with a glass of beer, sat Nobu. Before I could even bow to him or speak a word, he said,
"Sayuri-san, you've disappointed me."
"My goodness, I haven't had the honor of your company for 4 years, Nobu-san, and already in an instant I've disappointed you. What could I have done wrong so quickly?"
"I had a little bet with myself that your mouth would fall open at the sight of me.
The truth is, I'm too startled even to move."
"Come inside."
I did as Nobu told me, and then knelt at the end of the table.
"Now tell me, what has become of that danna of yours?" he asked.
"The truth is, he isn't my danna any longer."
"He didn't help you, did he?"
"No. He said he'd already used up whatever influence he has."
"That wouldn't have taken him long. Why didn't he save what little influence he had for you?"
"I haven't seen him in more than a year."
"You haven't seen me in more than 4 years, and I have saved my best influence for you. Why didn't you come to me before now?"
"But I've imagined you angry with me all this time. How could I have come to you?"
"How could you not? I have access to the perfect haven. You're the only one I'll give it to, Sayuri, and I won't give it even to you until you've bowed on the floor right in front of me and admitted how wrong you were. You wasted the very ripest years of your life on a fool."
I did what Nobu demanded of me. "Forgive me for my foolishness," I said. Afterward, Nobu told me about the nest he'd set aside. It was the home of his good friend Arashino Isamu, the kimono maker. He wrote the address of Mr. Arashino's home on a piece of paper and gave it to me.
"Sayuri," he said as he left me, "I don't know when we will see each other again or what the world will be like when we do, but I will think of you every time I need to be reminded that there is beauty and goodness in the world."
The Arashinos treated me with great kindness during the years I lived in their home. In the daytime, I worked with them. At night, I slept alongside their daughter and grandson on futons spread out on the floor of the workshop. Because I'd lived through adversity once before, what I learned about myself was like a reminder of something I'd once known but had nearly forgotten, namely, that beneath the elegant clothing and the clever conversation, my life had no complexity at all, but was as simple as a stone falling toward the ground. My whole purpose in everything during the past 10 years had been to win the affections of the chairman. Day after day, I watched the swift water of the Kamo River shallows rushing below the workshop. Sometimes I threw a petal into it, knowing that it would be carried all the way to Osaka before washing out to sea. I wondered if perhaps the chairman, sitting at his desk, might look out his window one afternoon and see that petal, and perhaps think of me. The war ended for us in August of 1945. Most anyone who lived in Japan during this time will tell you that it was the very bleakest moment in a long night of darkness. Our country wasn't simply defeated, it was destroyed. But by the spring of 1946, we'd all come to recognize that we would live through the ordeal of defeat. There were even those who believed Japan would one day be renewed. One bitter cold afternoon in November, 3 years after the end of the war, Mrs. Arashino came to say that someone wished to see me. I could tell from her expression that the visitor wasn't just another of the women from the neighborhood. But you can imagine my surprise when I reached the top of the stairs and saw Nobu. He was sitting in the workshop. "I thought the whole world had changed," I said. "But it can't be so, for Nobu-san has stayed exactly the same."
"I never change," he said. "But I haven't come here to chat. When are you coming back to Gion? Every month I telephone the Ichiriki to ask about you, and the mistress gives some excuse or other. I thought I might find you ill with some horrible disease. You're skinnier than you were, I suppose, but you look healthy enough to me. What's keeping you?"
"To tell the truth, the decision isn't mine. I've been waiting for Mother to reopen the Okiya. I'm as eager to get back to Gion as Nobu-san is to have me there."
"Then call that mother of yours and tell her that the time has come."
He took a little package and tossed it onto the mats next to me.
"Open the package I've brought you."
Wrapped inside paper and string and padded with layers of newspaper was a rock about the size of a fist. When I looked at it more closely, I saw it wasn't a rock at all, but a piece of concrete.
"You have in your hand some rubble from our factory in Osaka," Nobu told me. "Two of our four factories were destroyed. There's a danger our whole company may not survive the next few years."
"If it's a piece of Nobu-san, then I will cherish it."
"I didn't give it to you to cherish. I want you to help me turn it into a lovely jewel for you to keep."
"If Nobu-san knows how to do such a thing, please tell me and we'll all be rich."
"I have a task for you to do in Gion. If it works out as I hope, our company will be back on its feet in a year or so. When I ask you for that piece of concrete back and replace it with a jewel instead, the time will have come at last for me to become your danna."
My skin felt as cold as glass when I heard this, but I showed no sign of it. "How mysterious, Nobu-san. A task I could undertake, which would be helpful to Iwamura Electric?"
"It's an awful task, I won't lie to you. During the final 2 years before Gion closed, there was a man named Sato who used to go to parties as a guest of the prefectural governor. I want you to come back so you can entertain him."
I had to laugh when I heard this. "How horrible a task can that be?"
"You'll know how horrible it is if you remember him. He's irritating and he acts like a pig. He tells me he always sat across the table so he could stare at you. Maybe you saw him mentioned in the news magazines last month. He was just appointed Assistant Minister of Finance."
"My goodness," I said. "He must be very capable."
"He's capable of pouring sake into his mouth. That's the only thing I've ever seen him do. It's a tragedy that the future of a great company like ours should be affected by a man like him."
"Nobu-san," I said, "if it's important to make a good impression on the minister, perhaps you should ask the chairman to be there when you entertain him."
"The chairman is a busy man."
"But surely if the minister is important to the future of the company..."
"You worry about getting yourself there," Nobu said. "I'll worry about what's best for the company. I'll be very disappointed if you're not back in Gion by the end of the month."
That very night while the Arashino slept, I wrote to Mother. Whether my letter had the proper effect or whether Mother was already prepared to reopen the Okiya, I don't know. But a week later, an old woman's voice called out at the Arashino's door, and I rolled it open to find Auntie there. She was carrying a bag of coal in one hand and foodstuffs in the other to thank the Arashinos for their kindness toward me. The next day, I said a tearful farewell and went back to Gion, where Mother, Auntie, and I set about the task of putting things back in order. About a week after my return, I was finally ready to make my first appearance as a geisha again. I spent a day rushing from the hairdressers to the fortune tellers and then to the Ichiriki. I expected Nobu to arrive by himself, but when I finally heard him in the hallway, it was clear he'd brought the minister with him. I got my first good look at the minister only after introducing myself and going to kneel at the table. He didn't look at all familiar, though he'd claimed to have spent hours staring at me. I don't know how I managed to forget him, because I've never seen anyone who had more trouble just lugging his face around. He kept his chin tucked against his breastbone as though he couldn't quite hold up his head, and he had a peculiar lower jaw that protruded so that his breath seemed to blow right up his nose. Very soon we began playing a drinking game. Nobu and I may have let the minister lose a bit more often than we should have, because as we were trying to explain the rules to a drinking game he'd never played, his eyes became as unsteady as corks floating in the surf. All at once he stood up and headed off toward one corner of the room.
"Now, minister," Nobu said to him, "exactly where are you planning on going?"
The minister's answer was to let out a burp, which I considered a very well-spoken reply because it was apparent he was about to throw up. Nobu and I did our best to keep the minister kneeling in the doorway with his head suspended over the snow, but despite our efforts he soon tumbled out head first. Nobu and I could do nothing but look at one another in dismay.
"Why, Nobu-san," I said, "I didn't know how much fun your guest was going to be." "I believe we've killed him. And if you ask me, he deserved it. What an irritating man." "Nobu-san," I whispered, "do you think he actually enjoyed himself tonight? I mean, is this the sort of evening you had in mind?"
"It isn't a matter of what I had in mind. It's what he had in mind."
"I'm sure he'll have a better time if we make the atmosphere more festive somehow. Wouldn't you agree?"
"Bring a few more geisha next time if you think it will help," Nobu said. "Invite that older sister of yours. I suppose if you want someone loud and funny, you ought to speak to your old friend Pumpkin."
I knew almost nothing about Pumpkin's circumstances, except that she was back in Gion, so I went to speak with Auntie. "She's living in a sad little okia over in the Hanoi Cho section," Auntie told me. "Don't take pity on her and bring her back for a visit." That very afternoon, I found the okia Auntie had told me about. A young maid showed me into a reception room that smelled of wet ash. I waited a long while before Pumpkin at last came and slid open the door. Though she had the same broad face, her heavy cheeks had narrowed, leaving her with a gaunt elegance that was astonishing to me. After an awkward silence, she spoke.
"Why are you here?"
"The truth is," I said, "I saw Nobu Toshikazu recently and... actually, Pumpkin, he'll be bringing a certain man to Gion from time to time. I thought perhaps you'd be kind enough to help us entertain him. It's as simple as that." "I've stopped believing that anything in life is as simple as that," she said. "I know you think I'm stupid, but I think you probably have some other reason that you're not going to tell me about."
"I suppose I do have another reason," I said. "To tell the truth, I'd hoped that after all these years perhaps you and I might be friends, as we once were."
Pumpkin said nothing. "Chairman Iwamura and Nobu will be entertaining the minister again next Saturday at the Ichiriki Tea House," I told her. "If you'll join us, I'd be very pleased to see you there." On Saturday morning, I awakened early and slid back the paper screen over my window to find a cold rain falling against the glass. By noon, the temperature had dropped still further. Any number of parties that evening were cancelled because the streets were too hazardous. And at nightfall, Auntie telephoned the Ichiriki to be sure Iwamura Electric's party was still on. The mistress told us the telephone lines to Osaka were down and she couldn't be sure. So I bathed and dressed and walked over to the Ichiriki. I didn't really expect anyone to be there. But there at the table, holding a magazine with both hands, sat the chairman, looking at me over the tops of his reading glasses. Nearly 5 years had passed since I'd last seen him. I was so startled I couldn't even speak. Finally I managed to say, "My goodness, Chairman! who has left you here all by yourself. Let me bring you some sake.
I'd much rather have your company.
And here he removed his reading glasses and took a long look at me through narrowed eyes.
You're a lovely woman, Sayuri.
Why, Chairman, I said, I'll never believe another word you say. I had to spend a half hour at my makeup stand this evening to hide the sunken look of my cheeks.
I'm sure you've suffered worse hardships during the past several years than losing a bit of weight. I know I certainly have. Sometimes we get through adversity, Sayuri, only by imagining what a lovely place the world might be if our dreams should ever come true.
He gave me a sad smile that I found so beautiful, I lost myself staring at the perfect crescent of his lips. I hadn't even begun to reply before the door slid open and Mameha entered with Pumpkin right behind her. I was surprised to see Pumpkin. I hadn't expected she would come. Then the door slid open again, and Nobu and the minister entered, both glowing red from the cold. The minister grunted at Pumpkin and jerked his head to one side, telling her to move so he could squeeze in beside me. Introductions were made, and the first of many such evenings commenced. All through that winter, Nobu went on bringing the minister to Gion once or even twice every week. But beginning that March, and running all through the spring, the chairman and Nobu grew busy and brought the minister to Gion only twice. Then one day during the first week of June, I heard that my presence at the Ichiriki Tea House had been requested early that evening by Iwamura Electric. To my surprise, instead of the usual group around the table, I found only Nobu.
Sayuri, he said when I'd settled myself. I must tell you something. Last week, the minister and I had a talk with the proprietress of the Ichiriki. We made an inquiry about the possibility of the minister becoming your danna.
The minister, I said. Nobu-san, I don't understand. Is that what you wish to see happen?
Certainly not. But the minister has helped us immeasurably, and I had no choice.
I see, I said. So I was to be given to the minister because...
No one was trying to give you to the minister. He could never have afforded to be your danna anyway. I led him to believe Iwamura Electric would be willing to pay, which of course we wouldn't have been. I knew the answer beforehand, or I wouldn't have asked the question. The minister was terribly disappointed, you know. After he found out he wasn't going to be your danna, he said, "Could you arrange it just once?" I said, "Arrange what once? For you to be Sayuri's danna just once? You mean one evening?" And then he nodded. Well, I said, you listen to me, minister. If you think I would arrange for you to have even a quarter of a second alone with her, why should you have her?
Nobu-san, I hope the minister didn't take this too badly after all he's done for your company.
What if I'd come to you as he wanted me to? Would you have said, all right, Nobu-san, I'll do it for you?
Please, how can I answer such a question?
Easily. Just tell me you would never have done such a thing.
But, Nobu-san, I owe such a debt to you.
Nobu's face flared in anger.
If you're a woman who would do such a thing, I want you to leave this room right now and never speak to me again.
I would never do such a thing, I said. I thought this would calm him, but for a long, frightening moment he continued to glower at me. Finally, he let out his breath.
It's time you went and brought back that rock.
What rock?
The one I gave you last fall. The piece of concrete from the factory. Go and bring it.
I felt my skin turn to ice when I heard this, because I knew perfectly well what he was saying. The time had come for Nobu to propose himself as my danna. I thought of sending a maid to retrieve the rock for me, but I knew I could never tell her where to find it. So I made my way through the streets of Gion. By the time I joined Nobu in the room again, I felt I'd used up all the energy I had. If he spoke to me about becoming his mistress, I wasn't sure at all I would be able to dam up my feelings. I set the rock onto the table. Nobu picked it up with his fingers and held it in a towel wrapped around his hand.
I hope I didn't promise you a jewel this big, he said. I don't have that much money, but things are possible now that weren't possible before.
I knew Nobu was on the point of proposing himself as my danna, and so I waited every day for the news to reach me, but the weeks dragged on without any word. Then one hot afternoon at the end of June, nearly a month after I'd given back the rock, Mother brought the newspaper while I was eating lunch and opened it to show me an article entitled, Iwamura Electric Secures Financing from Mitsubishi Bank.
It's no wonder we've heard so much from Nobu Toshikazu these past few days. You must know he's proposed himself as your danna. Well, you can relax now, it's finally happening. We all know how fond you've been of Nobu these many years.
I went on gazing down at the table just like a proper daughter, but I'm sure I wore a pained expression on my face, because in a moment Mother went on,
"You mustn't be listless this way when Nobu wants you in his bed. Perhaps your health isn't what it should be. I'll send you to a doctor the moment you return from Amami."
The only Amami I'd ever heard of was a little island not far from Okinawa. I couldn't imagine this was the place she meant, but in fact, as Mother went on to tell me, the mistress of the Ichiriki had received a telephone call that very morning from Iwamura Electric concerning a trip to the island of Amami the following weekend. I'd been asked to go along with Mameha and Pumpkin and also another geisha.
"But Mother, it makes no sense at all," I said. "A weekend trip as far as Amami? The boat ride alone will take all day."
"Nothing of the sort. Iwamura Electric has arranged for all of you to travel there in an airplane," she said.
On Friday, I found myself looking out of an airplane for the first time. Spread out below was a broad vista of aqua blue ocean, mottled with the same jade green as a certain hair ornament Mameha sometimes wore. And then a frightening image came to mind. I saw myself cutting the bond of fate that held me to Nobu, and watching him fall all the long way into the ocean below. I don't mean this was just an idea or some sort of daydream. I mean that all at once I understood exactly how to do it. Of course, I wasn't really going to throw Nobu into the ocean, but I did have an understanding, just as clearly as if a window had been thrown open in my mind, of the one thing I could do to destroy my relationship with him forever. Nobu himself had told me how to do it at the Ichiriki tea house only a few weeks earlier. If I was the sort of woman who would give myself to the minister, he'd said, he wanted me to leave the room right then and would never speak to me again. This idea that had come to me, could I really do such a thing? I don't mean the act of seducing the minister, but could I do such a thing to Nobu? During the rest of the flight, I struggled with these thoughts. We arrived at our inn about an hour before sunset. The others admired the room in which we would all be staying, but I felt so agitated I could only pretend to admire it. The following morning after breakfast, we wandered the dirt streets of the little village and soon came upon an old wood building that looked like a warehouse with a sloped roof of thatch. We ended up walking around to the back, where Nobu climbed stone steps to open a door at the corner of the building, and the sunlight fell across a dusty stage built out of planking. Evidently, it had at one time been a warehouse, but was now the town's theater. When I first stepped inside, I didn't think very much about it. But after the door banged shut and we'd made our way to the street again, I had an image of myself lying there on the rutted flooring with the minister as the door creaked open and the sunlight fell across us. We would have no place to hide. Nobu couldn't possibly fail to see us. I had no idea how I would lure the minister to the theater with me, and even less idea how I would arrange for Nobu to find us there. Perhaps Pumpkin would take Nobu for a walk if I asked her to. I kept asking myself whether I was fully sane to be considering this plan, but whatever misgivings I may have felt, they weren't enough to stop me from going ahead with it. Clearly nothing would happen until I succeeded in drawing the minister aside. "Minister," I said to him quietly when we were back in the room, "why don't you and I explore the inn? I've been eager to see it, and we haven't had the time." I didn't wait for him to reply, but stood and walked from the room. I was relieved when he stepped out into the hallway a moment later to join me. "Minister, shall we take a walk back down to the village together?" He looked very confused by this. "We have an hour or so left in the afternoon," I went on, "and I remember something I'd very much like to see again." After a long pause, the minister said, "I'll need to use the toilet first." "Yes, that's fine," I told him. "You go and use the toilet, and when you're finished, wait right here for me and we'll take a walk together." I went back toward the room. Pumpkin was no longer at the table. I found her looking through her travel trunk. "Pumpkin, I need to ask a favor." I waited for her to tell me she was happy to help, but she just stood with her eyes on me. "The minister and I are about to go for a walk. I'm going to take him to the old theater and... I want you to bring Nobu there and... Pumpkin, this will sound very strange. I want you to discover us." "What are you up to, Sayuri?" she said. "I don't have time to explain it now, but it's terribly important, Pumpkin. Truthfully, my entire future is in your hands. Just make sure it's no one but you and Nobu, not the chairman for heaven's sake, or anyone else. I'll repay you in any way you'd like." She looked at me for a long moment. "So it's time for a favor from Pumpkin, is it?" she said. I didn't feel certain what she meant by this, but rather than explaining it to me, she left. I joined the minister in the corridor and we set out down the hill. I kept up a flow of conversation until a few minutes later when we came to a stop before the old theater with its thatched roof. The minister seemed puzzled. "Will you come inside with me for a moment, minister?" I said. He didn't seem to know what to make of this, but he followed me inside. And then we were standing in the murky light filtering under the eaves. "Minister," I said, "I understand you had a talk with the mistress of the Ichiriki about me, isn't that so?" The moment I said these words, the minister's face changed. He took a clumsy step toward me. Slowly he brought his body toward mine until we were pressed together. He took my arm, probably to pull me down onto the planking, but I stopped him. "The stage is too dusty," I said. "Please bring a mat." The minister did as I asked. Almost at once, he kicked off his shoes and was against me, with his arms around me tugging at the knot in my obi. He looked very relieved as I lay down on the mat on the floor. He was still fully dressed, but he lay down upon me at once. I heard the jingling of his belt and then the zip of his pants, and a moment later he was forcing himself inside me. I was about to push him off when I heard a scraping sound outside. It was the sound of someone on the stone steps. The minister raised his head and pointed it toward the door with only the mildest interest, as if he expected to see a bird there. And then the door creaked open and the sunlight flooded us. I had to squint, but I could make out two figures. There was Pumpkin. She had come to the theater just as I'd hoped she would. But the man peering down from beside her wasn't Nobu at all. I had no notion of why she had done it, but Pumpkin had brought the chairman instead. Back in Kyoto, I was carried along in the current of my life over the next few days. I had no choice but to put on my makeup as usual and attend engagements at the tea houses just as though nothing had changed in the world. Every time I went into the Ichiriki tea house, I was reminded that one day soon Nobu would summon me there to tell me the arrangements had been settled at last. Considering how busy he'd been over the past few months, I didn't expect to hear from him for some time, a week or two perhaps. But on Wednesday morning, 3 days after our return from Amami, I received word that Iwamura Electric had telephoned the Ichiriki Tea House to request my presence that evening. After 10 or 15 minutes of waiting for Nobu at the Ichiriki, I began to wonder if he was really coming. I knew I shouldn't do it, but I laid my head down on the table to rest, for I'd slept poorly these past nights. I didn't fall asleep, but I did drift for a time in my general sense of misery. Then I felt the chairman's hand touching my shoulder. He was seating himself on the very cushion where I'd expected Nobu to sit, and yet Nobu was nowhere to be seen. I felt so confused that for a moment I wondered if I was really awake, but it wasn't a dream. "May I please say, Chairman," I began as steadily as I could, "that my behavior on Amami..."
"I know what you're thinking, Sayuri, but I haven't come here to ask for your apology. Sit quietly a moment. I want to tell you about something that happened quite a number of years ago."
"Chairman, I feel so confused," I managed to say. "Please forgive me, but..."
"Just listen. You'll understand soon enough why I'm telling it to you. Do you recall a restaurant named Tsumio? One day, quite some years ago, 17 years ago to be exact, I went there for lunch with several of my associates. We were accompanied by a certain geisha named Izuko."
I recognized Izuko's name at once.
"We happened to finish up lunch a bit early," the chairman went on, "so I suggested we take a stroll by the Shirakawa stream on our way to the theater." By this time, I'd removed the chairman's handkerchief from my obi, and now, silently, I spread it onto the table and smoothed it so that his monogram was clearly visible.
"Where did you get this?"
"Chairman," I said, "all these years I've wondered if you knew I was the little girl you'd spoken to."
"Do you mean to say, even when you were an apprentice, you knew that I was the man who'd spoken to you?"
"I recognized the chairman the moment I saw him again, at the sumo tournament. To tell the truth, I'm amazed the chairman remembered me."
"Didn't you ever wonder why Mameha became your older sister?" he asked me.
"I don't understand. What does Mameha have to do with it?"
"Sayuri, I am the one who asked Mameha to take you under her care. I told her about a beautiful young girl I'd met with startling gray eyes, and asked that she help you if she ever came upon you in Gion. I said I would cover her expenses if necessary."
"Chairman, forgive me, but I so wish that at some time years ago you could have told me about all of this."
"There's a reason why I never could, Sayuri, and why I had to insist that Mameha not tell you either. It has to do with Nobu."
"Chairman," I said, "I know I've been unworthy of your kindness. This past weekend when I..."
"I confess, Sayuri," he interrupted, "that what happened on Amami has been very much on my mind. I was extremely angry with Pumpkin, and I demanded she tell me why she took me to the theater. She said you'd asked her to bring Nobu."
"Chairman, please," I began unsteadily.
"But before you say anything further, I only want to know why you did this thing."
"I'm deeply ashamed, Chairman," I managed to say at last, "but my motives were purely personal."
After a long moment, he sighed. "I'll tell you exactly why I'm asking. It will be impossible for you to grasp why I've come here tonight or why I've treated you as I have over the years if you don't understand my relationship with Nobu. One day, when I'd known you only a short time," he went on, "Nobu brought you a gift and gave it to you in front of everyone at a party. I hadn't realized how much affection he felt for you until that very moment. When I realized how he felt, the way he looked at you that evening, well, I knew in a moment that I couldn't possibly take away from him the thing he so clearly wanted. I made up my mind that I would keep my interest in you hidden so that Nobu could have you. Since my girlhood, I dreamed that one day the chairman would tell me he cared for me, and yet I'd never quite believed it would really happen. Please forgive me for what I'm about to say," I finally managed to begin. "What I did on Amami,
I did because of my feelings for you, Chairman. Every step I have taken in my life since I was a child in Gion, I have taken in the hope of bringing myself closer to you.
Look at me, Sayuri.
The chairman reached out his hand and took the collar of my robe to draw me toward him. He kissed me. Chairman, I said, why have you kissed me? You've just been speaking of me as a gift to Nobu-san.
Nobu gave you up, Sayuri. I've taken nothing away from him. After Pumpkin told me you'd intended that encounter for Nobu's eyes, I made up my mind to tell him what I'd seen, and when he reacted so angrily... Well, if he couldn't forgive you for what you'd done, it was clear to me he was never truly your destiny. Now, more than 30 years later, I sit here looking back on that evening with the chairman as the moment when all the grieving voices within me fell silent. Since the day I'd left Yoroido, I'd done nothing but worry that every turn of life's wheel would bring yet another obstacle into my path. And of course, it was the worrying and the struggle that had always made life so vividly real to me. But life softened into something much more pleasant after the chairman became my danna. I began to feel like a tree whose roots had at last broken into the rich, wet soil deep beneath the surface. I'd never before had occasion to think of myself as more fortunate than others, and yet now I was. Though I must say, I lived in that contented state a long while before I was finally able to look back and admit how desolate my life had once been. I'm sure I could never have told my story otherwise. I don't think any of us can speak about pain until we are no longer enduring it. On the afternoon when the chairman and I drank sake together in a ceremony at the Ichiriki tea house, something peculiar happened. I don't know why, but when I sipped from the smallest of the three cups we used, I let the sake wash over my tongue, and a single drop of it spilled from the corner of my mouth. I was wearing a five-crested kimono of black, with a dragon woven in gold and red encircling the hem up to my thighs. I recall watching the drop fall beneath my arm and roll down the black silk on my thigh until it came to a stop at the heavy silver threads of the dragon's teeth. I'm sure most geisha would call it a bad omen that I'd spilled sake, but to me, that droplet of moisture that had slipped from me like a tear seemed almost to tell the story of my life. It fell through empty space, with no control whatever over its destiny, rolled along a path of silk, and somehow came to rest there on the teeth of that dragon. I thought of the petals I'd thrown into the Kamo River shallows outside Mr. Arashino's workshop, imagining they might find their way to the chairman. It seemed to me that somehow, perhaps they had.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.